From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Gary Lilly.
Good morning, America, and good morning to all the troops serving our country out there. Good morning to my fellow veterans. Thank you, and welcome home. Good morning to all you folks listening in Australia, New Zealand, and Tasmania. I know there's dog handlers down there, and today our show is going to be about dog handling. My name is Gary Lilly, CB, can do. Sitting in the booth with me observing is Vance McCrum. He's a dog handler for the Air Force, was on our show before in War Dogs 1.
Good morning, Gary.
Good morning, Vance. Over in the our air boss today is Bob Gould, Airborne.
Good morning, America. Your left, your right. Hoo-ha. Airborne all the way.
Most people just say good morning.
That's for our first guest.
You're right. Our first guest is Jerry Corrigan, who is with the 101st Airborne, 327th Airborne Infantry. We've got a lot to... Bob, this is one day that I wish we had 2 hours at least. There's so many things I want to hear these guys talk about. We have three different dog handlers are going to be on. First up, Jerry Corrigan. And I got to start with these words, these famous words. He spoke with tears of 15 years how his dog and him had traveled about. His dog up and died, he up and died, and after 20 years he still grieves. Those were two of the more famous lines of a song for our generation, Mr. Bojangles. If you went to our website, you listeners, or received our email flyer for the show this week, you saw a dog being carried in a, I believe, a shelter half slung on a pole. Two troopers were on either end of the pole carrying it. There was a trooper about 40 feet in front in this field, and then another trooper about 40 feet in front. That was Jerry Corrigan. Jerry, that was your dog that was being carried. Welcome to Veterans Radio. We want to hear a little bit about that photograph. What was in there, Jerry?
Good morning, Gary.
Good morning.
Well... That photograph was taken by an Army photographer. The LZ where they picked up myself and the dog was quite a ways away from where we had been camping, so we had to walk down there. And while walking down, that was the photo he came up with. So
it looks like it was taken from a helicopter.
No, actually, he was standing on the top of the hill.
Okay.
That's a descending area.
Oh, I see.
Down, we were going down below, and General Willard B. Pearson was there, and all of the dignitaries. They wanted to make it a big to-do. Of course, I wasn't very celebratory that day.
I can imagine. Your dog's name was Sarge. What was Sarge's job?
Well, Sarge's job was to stay in front of me and to pick up on any human scent that he would come across, left, right, 100 yards, 150 yards, hopefully those distances, but if occasionally it wouldn't be until much closer. But very effective, saved a lot of lives, very, 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 very smart dogs and good dogs. And they, once you teach them to look for people, then that's all they'll look for. They'll ignore any wildlife or anything else around.
What? That's interesting that they wouldn't get distracted by wildlife. There were some critters out there to distract the dogs. What? Sarge was a scout dog, is that correct?
Yes, he was.
Tell us what happened. It was a nighttime firefight, was it?
It was my first night in the first time in combat. We had been dropped in surreptitiously 2 days before, and we had been walking only at night and staying hidden in the daytime. And we moved for 2 days until we reached the area objective that we were going to start to search and sweep through. There were other units all throughout that area, and we were going to kind of do a pincing force against the enemy in that area. And on the third night, we took him out. The needless to say, our dogs were the first to go with the 101st, so they weren't too readily acceptable to the idea that the dog could do a better job than they could. And I had difficulty. I have to keep the dog in front of all people or he can't function. And we had people who kept getting in front of me and saying, I've been here for 9 months, I'll trust my own eyes and ears. Okay. Which was understandable at the time. But we came to a gigantic elephant grass field, and the path ended and nobody knew where the heck to go. So they asked me if I thought the dog could get us across and to where we had to go to, and I said I was pretty sure that he could. And so I had him follow the scent trail through the grass, and he ended up perfectly on the other side of the trail. Anyway, to make a long story short, we did our mission, which was burn down an abandoned village and return back to camp. When we were halfway there, all of a sudden, all hell broke loose. It was pitch black out. You couldn't see anything. And the machine gun fire was ripping everywhere, and we were ripping back. We thought after it was all over, we got the better end of the deal. There were a lot of blood trails, bodies dragged out. There were several dead scattered around. And we hadn't lost anyone except Sarge.
So, this was Sarge's first time out in combat, too, and you
were
trying to hold him down, and what was he trying to do?
Well, he was trying to move ahead. He wanted to get up and move ahead. And
he wanted to get at the enemy, in other words.
Yes. Well, he wanted to keep moving. I don't know whether he just wanted to get the heck out of there. Because, you know, all the training you have in this, preparation to go over to Vietnam, where they have the live grenades going off and the machine gun fire over your head and so forth. So you're used to explosives and machine gun fire and stuff. But when this thing broke loose, it was the most terrifying moment of my life. Because I, first of all, did not expect it.
Right.
And secondly, it was just overwhelming. And I didn't know what would happen with me. I was, they were moving people up left and right. And I wasn't attached to anybody.
Right.
As a scout dog handler, it was just me and my dog. And I wasn't, I had nobody to tell me where to go or what to do.
You guys were sort of independent contractors out there.
Yeah, we were. And so that's how it happened. And
then that was kind of the saddest day for you. I know.
Yes. I liked the piece you read. I'll have to listen to that again from Bojangles.
Oh.
Because it is one of the most horrific, no, it has to be the most horrific time in my life, and one which carries great loss and, great survival grief and, why couldn't have I done a better job with...
Well, the photograph itself is a sad one to look at. You can see it emanates sadness.
Yes. I have another photograph I'm going to send you.
Oh, thank you so much.
I found one.
So the story on that photograph, just real quickly, because we're actually over time right now, Jerry, but I wanted to talk about Sarge. The way this photograph came up was when I was in Vietnam, I was a Michigan State Notre Dame fan, and they were 1-2 in the nation, and whoever won the last game of the season and they were playing each other was going to be national champions. It took a lot of time for the news to get to us, and weeks later I saw this a copy of the Stars and Stripes laying in a water puddle about an inch underwater, slid my hands under it, carried it a quarter mile or a half mile back to my hooch, spent days drying it out so I could read about the story. And whatever happened, being in that water must have washed the acid out or something, because remarkably, it stayed in good shape. And
yes,
I brought it
is.
Back. Yeah, and I brought it back home with me. And then other events, because of scanning the article and sending it to Vance McCrum and Johnny Mayo and Perry Money, who are coming up next, within a half an hour, I knew all the details about Sarge. And about 3 or 4 hours later, I had a photograph of you today at a reunion that had taken place a couple months before.
Mm.
And from there came the contact between you and I, and I told you that I'd had it the first 40 years. You should have it the rest of the time, and I sent you that that paper.
Well, I appreciate that.
Well,
and I still haven't forgotten. I'm going to send you a picture of me in the paper.
Ah, that's great.
But I also have another picture from that same day of the picture that you sent me. It's a picture of me and the dog, me saying goodbye to the dog, which was...
Oh.
Very difficult. But as long as you've seen everything else, you might as well see that.
I'd love to see it. As sad as it is, I'd love to see it.
Yes.
Jerry, as I mentioned, we're a couple minutes over on time allotted for this segment, but this I really wanted to cover it and talk to you about it. Thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio. We're going to go to some welcome homes. Is that not right, Bob?
I think we can do that, Gary. Thank you very much. Welcome home. Each week on Veterans Radio, we welcome home servicemen and women who have been stationed around the world in the service of their country. Dateline, Utah. Members of the Utah National Guard's I Corps Artillery spent 14 months in Afghanistan. They were training Afghan National Army troops. The soldiers arrived at Camp Shelby, Mississippi, earlier this week, and then it's going to be on home. Dateline, Fraser, Michigan. A little something right here in the backyard. After 14 months away from friends and family, including the last 12 in Iraq, 144 members of the Fraser-based 785th Military Police Battalion returned Thursday to banners, cheers, and a lot of love at the Burban U.S. Army Reserve Center in Fraser, Michigan. Dateline, Hutchinson, Minnesota. The Hutchinson National Guard welcome home troops from their, let me get this group right here. The 2nd Combined Arms Battalion, 136th Infantry. They just returned from Iraq. Okay, welcome home, guys. Welcome home is sponsored each week by the Marine Scholars Program of Ave Maria University. For more information regarding the Marine Scholar Program, visit them online at avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. That's 239-280-2552.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
How many of you are suffering from some kind of chronic pain? If you are, then you're just one of millions of people our age who just live with it. I strongly suggest that you give Quantum Physical Therapy a call at 734-483-9200. Quantum Physical Therapy is a multifaceted facility providing cutting-edge conventional and alternative rehabilitation services. The highly qualified and friendly staff at Quantum are the movement experts and are committed to coming up with a specific solution for your specific problem. Whether it's pain, weakness, swelling, nerve injury, amputation, disease, or age-related morbidity, they can help you lead a productive life. Quantum Physical Therapy has two locations, one at 5417 Whitaker Road in Ypsilanti, and the other at 6180 Michigan Avenue in Saline. That's Quantum Physical Therapy, 734-483-9200, or on the web at www.qptherapy.com.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. Listen up close. We got a lot of stuff to cover right now, and it's all fascinating. We have Johnny Mayo and Perry Money. Johnny, you were with the 173rd Airborne Brigade, and Perry, you were with the United States Marine Corps.
That's great. That's
good morning to you, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning. I want to ask comment on Johnny first. You're author of a book called Buck's Heroes, and I want to get to that at the end of the show. But right now, I want to talk about the other dogs. And you had the CIB Combat Infantryman's Badge, Bronze Star, Purple Heart, and Air Medal, and other service medals. You were at the Battle of Dock Tho.
No, not Dock Tho.
No?
No.
Oh, I beg your pardon then.
I was that was in 67. I was there in 70, 71.
Oh, okay. You were featured as the Vietnam-era dog handler in a special episode of Animal Warriors in Oliver North's War Stories. Mm-hmm. I got that one right. Okay, good. Before we get into your dogs, your information, I was fascinated by something that you and Perry sent me information. But, Johnny, you wrote about 39th Scout Dog Platoon's legend, Buddha. His tour of duty in combat was 1965-71. You said, "I don't know of another war dog's reputation that warrants hero status like the grumpy old Buddha." Now, that's not something that every dog handler I've ever talked to said that their dog was the best dog in Vietnam. What made Buddha so special?
Buddha's handler, Robert Brown, and Buddha arrived in Vietnam and at some point in late 65 and was working with Special Forces. And then were attached to the 39th Scout Dog Platoon in June of 66. And from that point, stayed with the 39th. And from 66 to, I found my lieutenant, Lieutenant Doc Woods, who crated all of our dogs up on the 24th of July, 1971, in Lethbridge English. So that was Buddha's tour of duty, was up until that date, and then more than likely, you know, Buddha went somewhere to be put down, along with all of our dogs in our platoon. But as far as a tour of duty as a scout dog, on point, you know, we haven't come across any records. I don't know of any, and nobody's contacted me yet that would a dog won't point for that long in the Vietnam War.
My goodness. And no wonder he was grumpy.
But he was, and I took a picture of him and my first sergeant in March of 71. And at that time, he was probably about 9 years old, maybe almost 10. Wow. But, you know, that was, for a working dog in Vietnam, that was an older dog, much older than most of them.
We're going to get back to you with your two dogs. They were Tiger and Kelly, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Perry, your dog was Missy. Tell us about Missy. Perry Money?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, tell us about Missy.
Well, she was a great dog, at least I thought she was. Kind of small, black and white German Shepherd mix. She weighed 69 pounds. Always thought of Missy, you know, she kind of took care of me and I took care of her. And great dog, loved to be petted, liked to be groomed. But when it come time to work and we put a work harness on her, she was all business, you know.
What was her business? What was she trained to do?
Our business was, my dog, Missy, was specifically trained to detect mines, booby traps, and tripwires. And our mission in Vietnam was to clear minefields, to lead Marines through heavily booby-trapped areas, and to walk point on combat patrols.
How good was Missy?
How big was she?
No, how good was she?
Well, Missy, according to Marine Corps records, was assigned to 17 combat commitments, which meant she served with for 17 different Marine Corps commands in Vietnam. Never, ever was there a Marine Corps casualty behind her.
I know a guy that, good friend Tom Filecki here in Ann Arbor, he was with the unit that was losing guys almost daily to mines and booby traps. I imagine they'd have loved to have had the opportunity to have had Missy with them.
Yeah, that was one of the problems, I guess, in a way. Somewhere around 1967, Marine Corps commanders and Army commanders sent a letter to the Pentagon that said, basically said, we need help. 75% of our casualties are due to mines, booby traps, and tripwire. So they started searching the country for contractors who could provide dogs to reduce those casualties. And a company in Raleigh, North Carolina, called Behavior Systems Incorporated, BSI, was awarded the contract, and they trained 28 dogs for the United States Army, and they were deployed in Vietnam in 1969. And then they trained another 28 dogs for the United States Marine Corps, and we were deployed into Vietnam in March of 1970. And with all the units that were there in the I Corps, and we were trying to cover them all, every Marine Corps unit wanted one of our dogs to walk point when they knew they were going into, you know, hostile territory. So they set up a priority list, you know, which Marine Corps unit really is facing the greatest danger. And that unit got a dog. So we were always on, everybody was out every day that we could work, but we could only work about 15 days because of the heat. And our dogs had to come back. The dogs get 3 days rest, get checked out by a vet, and then immediately get back on a chopper and fly back out to another Marine Corps unit. Everybody wanted one. There wasn't enough to go around. So those units that got my dog or one of the other guys' dogs, you know, to walk the point for them, they felt very fortunate for a couple of weeks to have the dogs with them.
I wanted to ask Johnny about his two dogs. I mentioned the Purple Heart for a reason, and there was a story that went behind your Purple Heart. Tell us about your two dogs, if you would.
My first dog, I went through scout dog training at Fort Benning, and graduated from there, and it was, I guess, June of 70. Arrived in Vietnam, you know, the whole class of handlers pretty much arrived at the same area to be assigned a dog at Ben Hoa. They asked for a few volunteers to go to what I've been told is the first mine dog training program that was created in Vietnam. So 10 of us volunteered. They assigned me a dog named Tiger. And they had selected him, I guess, because of his abilities in culling some of the dogs out to start this program to see if they could detect up to 4 feet deep. And the 173rd Airborne had specially requested a dog to detect that deep. So we worked 2 months, got him down to 95% at 4 feet, and arrived at the 173rd, and they had pretty much decided they didn't really need him. So they asked me if I wanted to get a new dog or just switch him back to Scout. And so that's what we did. Tiger was, he was a black and tan, a German Shepherd, probably medium build, probably weighed maybe 80, 85 pounds. And when we, in the process of changing over, because my dogs were trained to detect all the scents that the enemy, explosive scents the enemy used, and to sit within 3 feet of the buried ordnance, and with a little tripwire work. But going back to scout dog training, which is all airborne scent and tripwire work, you know, the transition had to happen, but it takes longer than a week to change back from mine to scout dog. So Tiger's Vietnam War was two missions. He hit a tripwire on our second mission out. And I actually did not get but a couple small pieces of shrapnel because of his profile. He was actually walking left off the trail going under brush. And he died about 10 days later from the infection from the shrapnel.
And that came unexpectedly to you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, well, you know, walking, when you're put on point, I've always, you know, every step you take is not taken for granted. You know, you don't know when the next step something's going to happen, whether it's going to be a tripwire or all hell's going to break loose. And so, you know, for me, when I wasn't on point, you always felt protected by the grunts because they were in front of you and behind you.
Right.
Every step on point.
But you thought he was getting better, and that was what I was asking. That news that he had died overnight was just a shock to you.
Well, they performed. It was on that particular day that they did surgery, and when I left the veterinary clinic, which was in Cameron, because they flew us down to Cameron for the surgery, everything looked good. But the vet tech met me at the door of the hooch the next morning early and said, "You know, he died during the night." And you know, you always expect this, but you never know how you're going to react.
Sure.
You know, of course, for a grown man at 20 years old, to break down crying because he just lost his best friend and his closest.
And they were your best friend.
Partner. I mean, when we were working with the grunts, you know, we would make that brief friendship for that day or two or three or four, but we would never see those guys again. So we never really knew who we were with. I mean, everybody always would greet you and, you know, sometimes want to touch the dog, but you know, we would never see those guys again. So the only living being you knew in the war was your dog.
When we're going to be in a break in about 3.5 minutes, and I want to come back to Perry Money. Don't let me forget, I want to ask you how the Camp Danang, no, what was the
Kaiser.
Name? Pardon me?
Camp Kaiser.
Camp Kaiser. I want to ask how Camp Kaiser got its name. But right now, Johnny, you got a Purple Heart. You were wounded, and your next dog was with you. Tell us about what happened there.
Well, Kelly was, after Tiger died, within 3 days, I was assigned Kelly, and they gave me just a few days to get used to. You know, I have to take control of him. One of our missions, and it was in February of 1971, he was given really strong alerts. To our right, so you know my eyesight's on him, and then you have to pretty much scan and try to watch beyond him, look beyond him at the same time. But there was a punji pit that I stepped into. Luckily, I was able to catch everything, but catch the punji sticks going to my chest, my knee and my hand was able to catch the edge of it. But I did. Take wounds in my knee and my left hand, and which we always heard of the importance of punji stakes for the BC was to get you out of the field, not necessarily kill you.
Sure.
But I was in the hospital 10 days from the infection, just from those wounds.
Well, they would treat those punji stakes. We don't need to go into what they treated them with, but to create an infection. But when you were hurt. And the medic tried to get to you. What did your dog do?
Well, Kelly, during this whole process, Kelly never breaks his alert. Because in a dog's, with his training, I mean, that's his hunting instinct. And he is doing what he is trained to do. And, you know, I'm not sure if he's really concerned about me. You know, but he never broke contact. Because my eyes really never broke contact with him. And what we had was a base camp that was to the right of that trail with a couple bunkers.
An enemy base camp.
And the enemy had cleared out. But often, as our ground troops would go into an area, you know, they could either go into the spider holes or just back away. But it was always pretty much their camps that they would come back to. But that's what he was alerting on. And then,
did he let the medic get to you?
Yes. Well, now, I only had a problem in my worrying about Kelly in case I was unconscious. Because part of our briefing that the scout dog handlers, when we were dropped in, and it depended on your dog. Tiger was a big teddy bear. Anybody could touch him. But I knew if I became unconscious and I had to give this briefing, that please give him time to understand, because it was part of our briefing that if the medic had to get to us, they were allowed, or they would have to take the dog down. And, you know, I sort of wrote a story in the book, in Buck's Heroes, about that. For a dog handler having to wake up in a hospital and realize that your dog had to be destroyed so that combat medic could get to you was a worry. You know, just one of those of many worries that you had.
We're going to a break right now. We'll be right back, and we'll pick up with Perry Money.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Sergeant Day Turner refused to surrender, even though two-thirds of his squad was out of action. Details after this.
If you're a recent Air Force veteran, you probably spend some time comparing your new civilian life with what you had on the Air Force. Maybe the grass isn't as green as you thought it would be. Well, you might have a chance to come back. We're looking for people in certain career fields to return to active duty. Maybe your job's on the list. For more information, call 1-800-423-USAF or log on at airforce.com. Cross into the blue with the U.S. Air Force. No one comes close.
Turner commanded a 9-man squad with a mission of holding a critical flank position. When overwhelming numbers of the enemy attacked under cover of withering artillery, mortar, and rocket fire, he withdrew his squad into a nearby house, determined to defend it to the last man. The enemy attacked again and again and were repulsed with heavy losses. Supported by direct tank fire, they finally gained an entrance. But Turner refused to surrender, although five of his men were wounded and one was killed. He boldly flung a can of flaming oil at the first wave of attackers, dispersing them, and fought doggedly from room to room, closing with the enemy in fierce hand-to-hand encounter. He hurled hand grenade for hand grenade, bayoneted two Germans who rushed the doorway he was defending, and fought on with the enemy's weapons when his own ammunition was expended. The savage fight raged for 4 hours, and finally the enemy surrendered. 25 prisoners were taken, 11 enemy dead, and a great number of wounded were counted.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Len Pitlack, CPA, is an award-winning consultant for the U.S. Small Business Development Center. Let him use his 25 years' experience to bring you, as an individual or small business owner, his professional and courteous tax and accounting services. Give Len Pitlack a call today at 734-993-1313.
Pat the Handyman and his team is ready to help you with your remodeling, repair, and painting projects. Call Pat the Handyman at 734-260-1158. That's 260-1158. Pat the Handyman is a veteran-owned business.
Schrader Yacht Sales, the East Coast's finest dealer of Chris Craft, Island Packet Yachts, Packet Craft, Parker Fishing Boats, and Nautic Star Boats. Schrader Yachts is located at the top of Barnicot Bay in Point Pleasant, New Jersey. Our good friend Ray Schrader provides you, the customer, with over 30 years' experience in boat sales, sail and power boats, both new and used. Schrader Yacht Sales offers a full-service storage facility and a reliable crew responsible for all of your boating needs. Specialists in electronics, they can accommodate your needs for radar, autopilot, air conditioning, GPS, heat, and communications. Give Ray a call at 732-899-8010. That's 732-899-8010, or go to SchraderYachts.com. That's SchraderYachts.com. Oh, by the way, tell Ray you heard about him on Veterans Radio, and he will personally deliver your new boat from Schrader Yachts anywhere there's water. Schrader Yachts, ready to serve all of your boating needs.
And we're back on Veterans Radio talking about War Dogs 2. And before we get to Perry Money and Camp Kaiser, we have a man on the phone, Porter Harvey. You have a story you want to tell about what happened in a battle with the dog handler and the dog?
Yeah, actually, first of all, I'd like to thank Jerry and all the other handlers. But Jerry, more than anything, I was in country with the 2nd of the 12th in the Michelin Rubber Plantation. Same time Jerry was there, and I never knew it all these years. I went to high school with Jerry.
Oh, really?
And, two people were held in the highest of you couldn't put them any higher on the totem pole for a grunt. And one was a medic, and the other was a dog handler. We had, I think, three different ones that worked with us. They did them on a rotation. They would wear their paws out, and where we were, their paws would get worn out. So they could only be in the field for a few days, and then they had to take them back in and patch them up. But sure. The morning of the Battle of Suitres, March 21, 67, it was at LZ Gold. We had saddled up to go bail out. I think it was 2nd of the 22nd was getting hit. that morning. It was during the Guam talks. Anyway, make a long story real short. We had gotten, they were very popular with us, and we lost not only the dog, but the dog handler. We lost both of them. And, you know, it was pretty sad. They worked with our platoon extensively, and I used to really enjoy, if you were fortunate enough to get with the dog and the dog handler at night, you could curl up with the dog and the dog and the dog handler, and he would alert if anything came. Otherwise, you could get some sleep, which was really great. But
Porter,
I wanted to thank the handlers and Jerry especially, because he was a super guy.
And you have just done so, Porter. Thank you for being on Veterans Radio and giving us those thoughts. I appreciate it, and we're going to go back to Perry Money, and the question I asked before, I'm sorry, Camp Kaiser.
Camp Kaiser, that's, there's some argument about the name of that compound. Kaiser was the first United States Marine Corps scout dog killed in action in Vietnam, and the camp was named after that Marine Corps scout dog. The Marine Corps apparently doesn't like camps named after animals, so they named the post officially Camp David Land after the first Marine Corps scout dog handler who was killed in action. But to me, it'll always be Camp Kaiser after that dog, you know.
Right. The man mentioned that was just on, Porter Harvey, mentioned about laying with the dog at night. Now, you guys were out in the Indian country and you were sleeping on the ground. Where did the dog lay, and what was it like, especially in the monsoons when everybody's wet?
I tell you what, you know, I came home from Vietnam, something was said about dogs, and I said, yeah, I've been sleeping with one for months and months and months. What I always did was, my dog was very protective of me personally when we laid down to take a break, so I'd chain her to my ankle, and then she'd curl up with me in my flak jacket and take a nap, and if somebody bothered us, they had a real serious problem on their hands. But yeah, you slept with the dog, and you know, if it was pouring down raining, the dog was under the poncho with you. You know, the dog's job was to protect you when the unit was moving, and when you weren't moving and you were kind of in a secure situation, it was your job then to protect the dog.
But the dog didn't know that the roles had reversed, I'm sure.
No, absolutely not. You know, he's. I guess I can tell this story real quick. We were with the 1st Marines, A Company, 1st Platoon, 1st Battalion, 1st Marines on Hill 11, and I had the commander, when I checked in, said, we're going to move out in about 2 hours, you know, find you a shady place, take a break. And so there's a little French cemetery on top of this little hill, and I got next to a tombstone in the shade, chained my dog to my leg, laid down and took a nap with her curled up, and I woke up with her jerking on my leg, you know. And I looked, and it was a Marine Corps staff sergeant rolling down the hill. And apparently what had happened, this guy really had a bad attitude. He walked by and kicked my dog.
Oh.
And she ripped his calf out. And I'm not sure if they had the artery stopped bleeding when they had him on the chopper or not, but he never returned to the field, you know. But
why would this guy?
The rest of the time we were with that unit, though, my dog was the ultimate hero, you know. Everybody wanted to carry my pack. Anything we wanted, we got, because apparently this guy was the one guy that the regular Marines would really like to see gone, and she got rid of him for
You know, I don't know if the outside world can laugh at stuff like that, but it is funny to somebody who's been there. Johnny, tell us a bit about Kelly. And tell us about any dog. I asked you to send me some thoughts, and one of them was reading your letters from home out loud to your dog and having it look at you like it understood every word.
Well, that's I'm pretty sure that was like common with all the handlers. You know, it's, you know, with everybody else in Vietnam, everything was so personal. You didn't have anybody to share it with, but you know, oftentimes there would you know, you'd be mail call, you get your letter, and you know, just reading aloud in I think there's other guys also has the same story that, you know, your dog's there if you're reading out loud. And, you know, of course, he's listening because you're talking to him, but maybe he's understanding a little more about home. And, you know, they all had homes in America, too. So that's, you know, that connection with you know, sharing word from home.
Who named the dogs?
As far as we know, basically all the dogs in the Vietnam War were donated, and the names given that was given to them, that the donors gave to them, that name stayed. And the only thing the military assigned to them was their ID number. But Tiger was Tiger in North Carolina, Asheville, North Carolina. That's where he was donated from by the Murray family. And then Kelly came from Kansas. And I was in touch with the Murray family for a year or so after I got back. And I sent a couple letters to the family in Kansas, and they never responded. But, you know, they had homes.
Right. And you don't know why people don't respond. There's as many people as there are, there's that many stories out there.
Right.
Now, you guys rode in choppers, and so you had two different experiences, Johnny. You had two different dogs. How did the dogs take to flying in the choppers?
Tiger was indifferent. You know, he would jump on and he'd settle down. But Kelly, I mean, it was more excitement in him, you know, about a lot of things. More adrenaline, I think, running through his body, because he knew he was going to the field. Now, you know, in the on switch for Perry, for the Marine dogs and, you know, the scout dogs and the mine dogs was that scouting harness. When you put that scouting harness on, that was their time to work. And when that choke chain was there, I mean, that was just a standard collar when they weren't working. But when that scouting harness went on, they knew it was time to work. And just by loading up, seeing the ruck, they know when you threw the ruck on. Because I was at LZ English. And, you know, when our unit had, you know, they would always have some of us on red alert, meaning we had to be on the chopper pad within 15 minutes. So when they would see us grab that ruck and go to the kennel and pick them up, I mean, they knew they were going, you know, to work. And when the scouting harness actually went on, that was the time to work. But Kelly, he loved flying.
Just like a dog in a car with the nose up.
Yes, often they couldn't get to the door, but it'd be that little strain on the, you know, right, tension on the leash, right, wanting to ease a little closer if they were standing.
Perry, when you saw action, when you had contact, what was the reaction of the dogs during contact, and how were they afterwards when the shooting and the fighting stopped?
Well, the Marine Corps dogs were trained similar to the way the Army dogs were. Our dog school on the island of Okinawa, all of our obedience training was done under fire. So the sound of weapons and mortars and grenades and all going off didn't impact the dogs very much. The first time that Missy and I were involved in a firefight, and different from me and maybe Johnny and some of the other dog handlers, our dogs always worked off-leash, and they worked in far in front of us as you could see them and keep visual contact with. And we were clearing a riverbank out near Fubai, and kind of in the western part of the I Corps, and we're clearing a riverbank, and I had one bodyguard with me, and Missy and the Marines and the popular forces were about 300 yards behind us, kind of crouched down in a tree line. And Missy went about 500 yards up the river, and I called her back, and then I started to send her south down the riverbank, and she throwed her head up. And I looked up, and I saw an enemy soldier in uniform, NVA regular, as they call them, stretching with an AK-47 over his shoulder in the morning sun. And just without thinking, I went ahead and took a shot and dropped the guy. Only problem was my dog was off leash, and when this guy hit the ground, there were about 50 more stood up around him. And I realized that I was out in the open. And for just a second, I about panicked. And I looked around, and all the Marines and all the South Vietnamese forces that had been hiding in the tree line, they broke an assault on the hill. And when they assaulted the hill, Missy broke and assaulted the hill too. Oh. And so, hey, I'm right in there with them, you know, wide open. Everybody hit this hill. And when the battle was over, and we were doing a body count, and the dust kind of settled, I realized I didn't know where my dog was at, and I panicked. So we started searching for my dog, and we finally found her in a little thicket.
Right.
There was the commander of the NVA unit.
Perry, I'm going to have to come back to it. We've got to go to a break right now. Gary Lilly and Associates is now Sperry Van Ness Lilly and Associates, the newest Michigan affiliate of a leader in the commercial real estate industry, Sperry Van Ness. More than 800 Sperry Van Ness advisors in 136 markets sold nearly $11 billion in commercial real estate last year. That was done by putting the client's interest first, thereby generating maximum return for every property. When we list a property, we immediately place it on 6 internet commercial listing services and email it to 40,000 prospective buyers and 60,000 commercial brokers. We offer to split the commission 50-50. That means your interests, not ours, are placed first. To learn more, call Sperry Van Ness Lilly & Associates Commercial Realtors at 800-345-6694. That's 800-345-6694. Be advised, there is a difference.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back with Perry Money talking about the battle along the riverbank. And I apologize for having to cut you off right there, but other stations were going to break right at the same time. Perry, you were talking about at the end of the battle when you were policing the area, checking things out, you couldn't find your dog, Missy. Tell us what happened then.
Well, I panicked, and the Marines joined in when we started just a panic search for her. And we finally found her. She had a wounded North Vietnamese soldier pinned underneath a brush pile, just chewing on him, you know. And we pulled her out of the brush pile, and then we drug this guy out. And it turned out he was the unit commander. He still had his maps and his orders and all kind of good stuff on him, you know, which I guess you can credit her with capturing the commander of that unit as a prisoner of war. He had a bullet wound in his leg. We treated his wounds and called in a chopper, you know, the medevac came out and gave him to Netherlands Intelligence. But, you know, there for a minute, you know, a Marine losing his dog is just something that you would never, ever want to face, you know, not actually losing it. How do you do that, you know? I was really, really tickled to death when we, you know, my dog was right there, you know. And it was one of those situations, you know, my dog alerted to something she wasn't specifically trying to. She alerted to an enemy base camp. The Marines charged through, and when the battle was over, there was absolutely no Marine Corps casualties, and we had a very heavy body count of enemy soldiers. So
there were no Marine casualties, and isn't that astounding?
And you credit the dog, you know. And I told a story one time to a group of school students talking about my dog, you know. And this fifth grader stood up and asked me, you know, after I had finished, said, looked at me and said, "Were you really that good?" And I said, "No, I wasn't that good. I said, my dog was that good, and I was that lucky to have her."
Johnny, you were talking about, or you told me before, one of you was talking about the animals that were out there. And you had talked about Kelly and the wild pig chase.
Well, see, I worked both of mine off-leash also, where the majority of all the Vietnam scout dog handlers were at the end of a 6-foot leash. I mean, a huge majority of them. But luckily, I was able to do both of mine off. But Walking Point and Kelly alerted, you know, the standard alert, strong alert, and, you know, just like lightning, one of the little feral pigs darted across the trail. Well, you know, you can train for so much, but there's so many things you don't train for. Well, Kelly broke rank and all through the sawgrass, the elephant grass. You could see his body mass, you know, bending the grass. And luckily, he just did a big horseshoe loop and came back through the middle of the platoon, and I was able to intercept him. But you know, when a dog alerted, that's, you know, when they were off leash like that, when they alerted, and the way I controlled mine was to give them to stay and come, was I would use, since you couldn't make any voice commands controlling the dog, I could click my tongue off the roof of my mouth to make a click, and that's how I controlled him with the stay and come to me when I needed him to stop.
You
but
guys
when
did...
the when like I said, when his adrenaline and the hunting instinct took over on this little furry creature darting across the trail, I guess he decided he needed to have some fun or find something to eat.
Well, that brings up a question. Food. You guys, I assume they didn't carry their own food, so that was up to you guys. Is that right, Perry?
Yes, you had to carry a minimum of, at least a Marine Corps dog, having carried a minimum of 5 days food for his dog and a minimum of 5 days fresh water for the dog. And if you were on patrol for 15 days, you could be guaranteed of getting resupplied at least every 5 days. Whether you had, you know, you could drink your water with an iodine pill out of the river, but you didn't want your dog to drink it. So I think my pack, I weighed it one time, my rucksack, you know, as they called it, and I think it weighed 124 pounds. The water, the dog food, and 3 days rations for me and ammo and all. It was a lot to lug.
In the
dry season, we carried up to 14 quarts, so 3.5 gallons, and then for 5 days. We were also, you know, carrying for 5 days, and then the monsoon, you know, you carry 8-9 quarts.
There was a lot of leeches and snakes and everything. Did they ever bother the dogs?
Well, the biggest problem we had was with ticks. We were really, had been trained that this dog tick in Southeast Asia carried a blood disease that really was devastating to the dog. So we were more concerned about that. So we groomed, at least, you know, Marine Corps dog handlers, every time we got a break, he took his dog and he'd sit down with her and he'd brush her and check her very closely for leeches. We never encountered a snake while on patrol. And I assume that most of the snakes there just kind of stayed out of our way, you know, or maybe we were just fortunate. Leeches, big thing was in water, you know. Whenever you cross the stream with your dog, first thing you did was you check yourself for leeches and then you check your dog. But I never had a leech on my dog.
But I assume you picked up a few yourself.
Yeah, that's okay. You know, that insect repellent, you know, when one grabs hold a little salt or a little of that mosquito spray that we had, spray them and they curl right up and fall off.
Now, in our unit, we did a monthly dip in Malathion. They had a big tank, and you just rolled the dog over in it, and that was almost just like clockwork, good for about 30 days for the ticks, because, you know, 35 days, they would start picking them up. But yeah, that was just a routine. And you find out years later how.
Johnny.
Yeah, the Marine Corps did the same thing. Whenever you came back in from a commitment with a unit, the first thing you did was went to the vet station, and you had your dog weighed. The Marine Corps expect your dog to come back at the same weight that it went out. That's kind of evidence you had taken care of your dog. The vet and the vet tech would take blood samples, do a thorough examination of the dog. Then you take your dog outside and run it through this concrete vat of sheep dip, we called it, and I think it was a malathion solution of some sort. And we did that every time we come in. So, you know, we really, with that kind of protection, we didn't have much problem with the ticks itself.
We've got a couple of minutes left. Johnny, you published a wonderful book called Buck's Heroes. And it's the story of the war dogs, and it's the story of a dog named Buck that you had many, many years later. And there's a photograph that was turned into a painting of your dog Buck sitting in front of the wall looking up at it. And the name of that painting is Buck's Heroes. I thought it was totally posed. Tell us a little bit about that photograph and about your book, Buck's Heroes, and how people can buy it. It's wonderful.
Okay. In 2000, 1999 and 2000 was the 2 years that a lot was happening with pulling us all together, the Vietnam dog handlers, and a lot changing. The national reunion was in Washington, D.C. My first trip to the wall, I had been to Fort Benning a week earlier, but in those 2 weeks was the first meeting with other dog handlers since I left Vietnam. And we go to Washington, and the day that we dedicate a wreath on the Friday of the reunion, Buck is really the only personal dog there. There was a military working dog there for the wreath event, for the wreath laying. But I took several pictures of Buck that early on the morning of the 13th. And this one picture, he's looking up at the wall. Immediately when I saw it, when I got home, you know, when you develop your film, it created the thoughts. And an artist saw that later and did artwork within 2 months of the image of my war dog and wall looking back. But my war dog is representing the war dogs. And then I started the thoughts of what if their spirits were there. And for us 200 dog handlers there that weekend, our dog spirits were there. And my storyline in the book is this: what if all 4,000 dogs' spirits are there that day, and they are able to share their true stories of the Vietnam War with Buck? And so that's the setting for the book, and I've tried to cover, you know, the real stories and some personal, some overlapping all of the services, because many of us experience so many of the same things. Title of the book is Buck's Heroes. I've got two websites, but War Dog Publishing is one of my websites that people can purchase it from. And it's received from all across the country, because I have the largest traveling war dog exhibit in the country, and I'm invited all over. But the big events that I do go to, there's people coming from all over the country. So they're able to go back home to every state in the Union, and they share these stories about the book and War Dogs with people. But wardogpublishing.com, if people go there, they can purchase it.
Okay, and if people want to get a hold of you, I'm going to ask them to get a hold of Veterans Radio. Go to veteransradio.net. We have a contact page. Send us an email and tell us that they want to get a hold of Johnny Mayo about Buck's Heroes and about his traveling exhibit. A few of the things that are in there, they're just so touching. There's one of the paintings has Buck looking in to the wall and a German Shepherd looking back at him. And in another one, there's the German Shepherd's inside the wall looking out at Buck.
Yes.
We've got the music. We're counting down. We're about ready to go out. I want to thank our sponsors, Marine Scholars Fund, Quantum Physical Therapy, Legal Help for Vets, Len Pitlack, CPA, Schrader Yacht Sales, Barry Van Ness, Lillian Associates, and Pat the Handyman. Listen in next week when we have These Scars Are Sacred, written by Elliot Sorm, a book used by VA hospitals. In the meantime, you are dismissed.
Thank you, Gary.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of our guests and are not necessarily those of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.